Well, thank you, Melissa, for that kind introduction that my ego tells me I so richly deserve it. rarely receive. And if only it were true. Well, good morning, everyone. My name is Rob S., and I have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body, surely by the grace of a loving God, and by the power that I found as the result of the program in the textbook Alcoholics Anonymous, by the awakened members of Sacred 12-Step Fellowships that have led me to and through this program and continue to guide me today, and by the service that God leads me to and that I'm allowed and encouraged to participate in, and by a host of teachers in my life, I've been moved from that seemingly hopeless state of mind and body to that state that I experience today as recovered, free. Free. Able to consistently see the truth. Surely able to consistently see the truth about the first of whatever, as Melissa said, that is on the outside that I seek, that I thirst, that I crave. More importantly than the physical, I am able to consistently see the truth about the defective mind and the defective thinking and the defective characteristics that lie within that egoic thinking mind that will take me back to the place where that first next seems plausible. More importantly than both of those, I am able to consistently see the truth today that of myself I am nothing without a power of God at work in and through my life. And without my responsibility to deepen and broaden my relationship through some simple daily disciplines and ongoing service and ceaseless sacrifice and gladly and gratefully given of myself, I am nothing, and without that I am doomed to repeat. But when I engage in those three simple acknowledgments of truth and consistently keep them alive in my heart, I can walk freely with my head held high and a little bit of dignity. And that's not something I could say for the better part of four decades. When I first was approached to ask, to speak on the history of Alcoholics Anonymous, several thoughts went through my mind. I'm happy to do it. Please let me acknowledge up front that I do not speak for Alcoholics Anonymous. No one surely does. I'm not an expert on the book Alcoholics Anonymous. I have had an experience with that book. I'm not an expert on the history of Alcoholics Anonymous or the history of other 12-step fellowships or even the recovery history as a whole. I have some familiarity with it. There are legions of seekers, we'll say, who have found their one, at least, avenue of excitement or interest or purpose to explore in depth. Archivists and the like, and I have availed myself to them. I mean, and I assure you, with the most oddball, what coffee did they use in in the downtown? Where, and within a week, you're going to get the answer, or three different answers. So, when I stand here before you to speak on the history of Alcoholics Anonymous, it lies somewhere between history, myth, and legend. Perhaps all wrapped up into one. But mostly when I was approached to do this, it was, my first thought was, well, what do they want? And my reaction is, I don't have that. And my thought was, well, what do they need? Oh, I mean, first of all, when we think of history, I'll always, that classic, there's two types of people in the world. Well, in this particular category, there are two types of people in the world. There are people who couldn't wait for third period history in high school. And then there was the other 50% of the people who, you know, for some reason always had some excuse to go to the school nurse around third period. So what do you need? You know, and some of that I think is because of just the way we oftentimes were introduced to history. You know, what do you need? Sure, I've got names and dates and facts and figures, and but that's just pablum. That's just the list. That's just the, you know, the chronological telling. And history is more than that. History is, if it doesn't come alive, if it doesn't entice you, if it doesn't, you know, ensnare you with what happens next, then it's just facts and figures and dates on a page, and should probably just be forgotten. You know, what's today? The 8th. Years ago, this coming Tuesday, April 10th. This book was published. As it says, this, we hope someday this small chip of a book will be launched upon the world. And it was, April 10th, 1939. Does it matter? Matters to me. It changed my life. It has changed many individuals' lives that I know. But the difference between that simple date and how it matters to me is where history can become alive. You know, I'll give you an example of you know, in a couple of weeks. On April 18th, we'll be celebrating the 243rd anniversary of a critical day in this country's history. This guy named Paul Revere rode through Middlesex County in Massachusetts and rang an alarm. Date, fact, true, verified, all of that. And it means nothing. But when you take, when you hear it from the lips of, or from the writings of one of the most, one of the rock star poets of the 19th century, listen, my children, and you shall hear of the midnight ride of Paul Revere. 'Twas the 18th of April in 75, hardly a man is now alive who remembers that famous day in here. And then it goes on and on, as I'm sure many of you know. One if by land and two if by sea, and I on the opposite shore shall be ready to ride and sound the alarm to every Middlesex village and farm. You know, all of a sudden, there's... Oh, I get it. All of a sudden, you can begin to imagine the sparks being struck by the steed. The British are coming, and all of that. And so all of a sudden, history has become alive, and it's not just a date on the page. In the handout that I provided, it came from a friend of mine, Bill L., and from his website, and it lists 50 books tracing AA history and influences and whatnot. And I was looking down and all of a sudden, wow, I've read a lot of those. Yeah. Doesn't make me an expert. But it makes me more informed. So I can know an awful lot of the history. I can know the dates, I can know the times, I can know the names and all of that, but that just gives me some knowledge. But history, as I said, is more than that. History has to become not so much names and dates and facts and figures, but it has to become a story. And it's not just the story of Alcoholics Anonymous. even that can be interesting. That interests people that have no connection whatsoever with 12-step fellowships. There's one of the most recent and excellent documentary movie done on Bill Wilson was done by two non-alcoholics. Bill W. the movie, the creative force behind Alcoholics Anonymous, which is streaming free on PBS website until April 30th. And if you want the address, I can give it to you after the meeting. But it's the story that matters. And more importantly than that, even if it's just a story that we may find interesting, it only becomes alive when how does it relate to my story? Where is my relationship to this history? Because lest we forget, each and every one of us is a current member, a contemporary of OA. You are a part of this thing. You are a part of its history. You are a part of its story. And your story and the story of this 12-step fellowship interact. And as a result, how can I best become or better become an active contributing member? How can I best become or better become someone who can extend a hand outward, telling both my story and incorporating the legion of individuals who have preceded me, each with their own story, that have developed into a cumulative history, the cumulative story. My experience in Alcoholics Anonymous is just that I was shown in so many different ways, both from literature as well as from personal experience, as well as some, research on my own, I've discovered how much I owe to those who have preceded me. And some portion of my story involves keeping that alive. Even if it's merely perpetrating some of the myths that's continued the founding day June 10th, 1935 is called Founders Day in Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, there's plenty of historical research that shows that Dr. Bob wasn't even in Akron on June 10th. It's not going to change.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter. It's just a date. But what's the story behind that? So as we embark on this, with that in mind, my thought is more importantly than just, you pick out any of those initial books on that list. Books from World Services, Alcoholics Anonymous, Comes of Age, Pass It On, Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers, histories written within the fellowship and as such have both some veracity as well as some myth telling and whatnot. There is another book, Ernie Kurtz, Not God, History of Alcoholics Anonymous, started off as his dissertation and became really a lifelong work that he developed. But you will get an awful lot of accurate information. More than you need. Half of this book is just footnotes. Good Lord. So you can find out the facts. But more importantly than that, what were the ideas that led up to this? What were the founding ideas, and where were those founding ideas, where did they stem from? Why and where are we even here? almost 60 years after the founding of this fellowship, you know, 80 some odd years after the founding of Alcoholics Anonymous. But the story of treatment, the story of recovery, you know, goes back much, much further than that. And those, at least in this initial week, I'd like to explore some of those ideas. Next week, we will get more into the actual founding of Alcoholics Anonymous and its early growth, and then the final week, the development of that and how it has spread out into over 650 other 12-step fellowships and whatnot, and both its growth, its change, and some of the controversies that involve it. So with that in mind, why are we even here in this country, with, you know, in a 12-step fellowship? I give you the apple. A simple food. It was one of the principal non-commercial agricultural products of the colonial era and on into the early 1800s. Every farmer, every town had orchards. It was critical, crucial to their well-being because the water wasn't that good. But out of this, you press it, you let it sit for a while, let it ferment, and you get cider. Hard cider. Hard, good, pure cider. Cider was the drink of everyday life. You had it for breakfast, you had it for lunch, you had it for dinner. It was served to laborers as part of their normal daily routine. Other fermented products that were served on a regular basis were beer and wine, none of which were thought of as containing alcohol. They had ingredients that were similar to alcohol, but it was spirituous liquors, the rum and the whiskeys that were the soon to be both in were initially thought of as, what was the expression, God's great gift, or the great gift of God. Until about 60 years later, when it certainly became demon rum. But this was a staple on every farmer and town folk person, served in taverns, you know, without no one ever gave it even a thought. This country was born by a bunch of drunkards. They weren't called drunkards and inebriates, you know. It was, I say that loosely, you know, and again, you know, but it was, we were not a temperate society. Many people were temperate. And again, I'll even, you know, get into that word because it has so many different meanings and connotations. But I'll even, you know, take this, since we're talking about ideas, I'll even take this a little bit further. Because again, it represents to me one of the critical reasons why I'm here, this, I'm an active contributing member of a 12-step fellowship. This, in common parlance, has become known as coming from, in the creation myth of the Judeo-Christian culture or heritage, I take you back to the Garden of Eden, Genesis. And God created man and woman. And he offered man and woman to eat and enjoy all that was available and of that bounty and rule over the livestock and all the plants, and with the exception of one. Now these days, you know, it's commonly referred to mistakenly, but once again, myth becomes fact, that Eve picked the apple. But the original commandment was that ye shall not eat from the tree of knowledge. But the serpent comes and convinces Eve that she really should and that she should share it with Adam. And when they did, what happened? Their eyes were opened and they saw themselves naked. And at that very moment, two things happened. Several things happened. They initially felt shame and guilt and remorse. And they saw themselves as naked and they clothed themselves with fig leaves. And so the fashion industry was born. And the diet industry was born at that same time. And it would take several millennium later until the glossy pages were developed, until glossy magazines could perpetrate that myth of less than and not good enough and, you know, shame and guilt and remorse from physical appearance. But then God shows up and says, I told you not to eat of the apple, Adam. Why did you do it? And what's he do? Blames Eve. The first recorded case. But I bring that up, the myth of, because once again, what God asked or told them of them was, do not eat of the tree of knowledge. But man, in his thirst, in his craving, wanted to be as of God. And that's what the serpent told him, that if you ate of the book from the tree of knowledge, you would be as of God and you would know all. In many ways, and we'll talk about this in the coming weeks, in a letter between Bill Wilson and Carl Jung, when he talks about spiritus contra spiritum, spiritus, the highest, you know, experience of the spirit and communion with God versus spiritum. You know, the most lowest of poisons. You know, we all go into a wine and spirit shop. You know, spiritus liquors. You know, and but both are attempts. We seek both. We thirst for both. One is a healthy seeking, and the other is a misdirected seeking. So too, right from all of our creation myths, for the most part, in all cultures, all deal with that misdirection of man seeking to be God. The blessing that I have found, I know I'm bouncing around in and out of personal experience, but it will relate. My experience on a personal level is that that was to the blessing of alcoholism was to me only the avenue that led me into my experience of limitation, of being not God, of being fallible, of being broken, of being a perfectly imperfect human. I didn't realize that at the time. I just thought I drank too much. Mm-hmm. I just thought that I was shameful, weak-willed, unable to control. Right from the very get-go, all of our cultures have had that some variation on that myth of the lack of control, that seeking and thirsting for to be God. Back to the apple and cider. Alcoholics Anonymous, as I mentioned, formed, founded with the final sobriety date of Dr. Robert Holbrook Smith on June 10, 1935, as a result of his meeting with William Griffith Wilson, Bill Wilson, several weeks prior. But the history of recovery, the story of recovery, has been laced throughout our country from the very beginning. In the late 70s, as I said, grog, cider, wine, beer were common throughout the colonies. Rum was the most imported product into the New England ports. It gets cold up there. And around the founding of this, by the time of the founding of this country, there were over 2,500 distilleries within this country to begin with. And yet, there was drunkenness then. There has always been drunkenness. There has been drunkenness, and there has been attempts to help the inebriate through centuries. I mentioned the founding, you know, Judeo-Christian creation myth. Move forward a couple of centuries, and I will I offer you this just in case you are wondering that alcoholism is not a new threat to the community, to society. Who hath woe, who hath sorrow, who hath contentions, who hath babbling, who hath wounds without cause, who hath redness of eyes? They that tarry long at the wine, they that go in to seek mixed wine. Look not upon the wine when it is red, when it giveth its color in the cup, when it moveth itself aright. At the last it biteth like a serpent and stingeth like a viper. Thine eyes shall behold strange things, and thy heart shall utter perverse things. Yea, thou shalt be as thou liest down in the midst of the sea, or he that lieth upon the top of a mast. They have stricken me, shalt thou say, and I was not sick. They have beaten me, and I felt it not. And when I awake, I will seek it yet again. Proverbs 23. Solomon was speaking of the drunkard. It's not a new affliction. As long as man has crushed grapes, as long as man has found how to ferment grain, we have had those who have thirsted beyond what is either normal, acceptable, or healthy. So in the 1700s, late 1700s, Dr. Rush. William Rush? I don't know. Rush. I could remember it. But Dr. Rush, he was a member of the Continental Congress, signer of the Declaration of Independence, one of the foremost physicians of the in the nation. He was a professor at the Philadelphia College of Physicians at the University of Pennsylvania. Taught an incredible number of most of the doctors in this country had some connection to his teachings, and he wrote innumerable numbers of papers, and one of which was his talks on alcoholism. He was simultaneously there was a Dr. Trotter in England, both of whom came up with similar ideas on the disease concept of alcoholism. 1790s, and they're talking about it as a disease, and they talked about some physical infirmities, but mostly they talk about the compulsion of the mind that takes one to a point where they cannot stop. At that point, he was went against much of the belief of the treatment of inebriates. Alcoholism wasn't even a word at that point. There was even the language of recovery has morphed and changed and over the centuries. I mentioned temperance. Temperance once initially in the 1700s, they weren't talking about total abstinence. They were talking about being moderate. When someone was drinking too much spirituous liquors, when there were too much whiskey and too much rum involved, even Rush recommended was that they drink only beer, wine, or cider, because they didn't have because those elements didn't have the wasn't alcohol. It just had some of the elements of. That's how ingrained and common this it would drinking cider was the same as all of us walking around with bottles of water these days, wherever we are, you know? And he went much against the common thought at that point, and as a result, he also had some pretty odd treatments, many of which were still, you know, in vogue in those days. But he believed the treatment, he saw a lot of it as an imbalance of the four humors, you know, yellow bile, black bile, blood, and bile, whatever. And there were certain recommended treatments for that, bleeding through, you know, through leeches and or just outright bleeding. Emetics, induced nausea, some pretty ghastly treatments back in those days. And he was pretty aggressive in those, and basically almost lost his practice until he was made treasurer of the Mint. So if you're a failed businessman, you can still get a job in the government.
There you have it.
But I digress. At that point, the average per capita liquor consumption per person in this country in the late 1900s was about 2.1 gallons a year. By 1830, it had risen up to 7.1. The number of distilleries had hit almost 15,000. From about the 1790s up through the 1830s and 1840s, drinking, we went on a binge as a country. Within that is also some of the roots of our national myths. The rugged individual. We had increased immigration. We had large numbers of rural people moving into cities, even in the early 1800s. Not even as much, you know, not as much as during the Industrial Revolution and whatnot. But what was happening is we had larger and larger number of single or individual men living on their own in cities and taverns, which had, through the colonial eras and the early portion of it, which were the center of village community, began to be replaced by saloons. Mm-hmm. One was looked upon as a positive aspect to the community, and the other, you know, began to be looked upon as dens of iniquity and the like. In this period of 1800 to 1830, 1840, antebellum time in this country, along with the rise of increased drinking and increased inebriation and increased drunkenness, we began to see also the rise of the early days of prohibitionism. Temperance societies began to form. And they grew along two different lines. One spoke of temperance as returning the drunkard to a moderate place of drinking. Very few of them spoke of, you know, or many of them did not speak of total abstinence. And then the other fork of the temperance unions went farther along those lines, and they looked upon inebriation and drunkenness as a moral failing, as a lack of will, and total abstinence needed to be undertaken by the individual. And both of those progressed in sort of equal number throughout that period of time. 1840. Actually, let me digress a little bit. Also during that period, closer in the 1830s and whatnot, as some of these, both avenues of the temperance movement, the ones that called only for for personal moderation and those that called for total abstinence. The ones that called for total abstinence began to look upon, as I said, as when they saw this as moral, a failing, they also began to go toward the avenue where we need then to regulate. Because the drunkard, the inebriate, the addict, the opiate user is unable to control it on his own. And not only that, that even moderation is just a precursor to someone moving into. And so therefore what we need to do is to call for total prohibition. And by the 1830s, the roots of our the prohibition movement of the 20th century were finding its roots. In 1840, throughout all of this, there were various temperance unions, reform clubs, and concurrent with that, there were also drinking clubs, gentlemen's clubs, and in Baltimore, 1840, there was a charter drinking club that was meeting one night and got into a large argument with the bar owner, who said that all of these temperance people were nothing but a bunch of hypocrites. And so this of these 20 members of this drinking club, they selected four of them to go out and investigate the temperance movements in Baltimore. And they came back, and six or eight of them were so convinced of the propriety of these temperance unions that they signed their own temperance agreement with each other and formed their own temperance club, and they called themselves the Washingtonians Temperance Society of Baltimore, or something like that. And at this point, they were somewhat different in that they signed their pledge that they would help and assist each other in not drinking, in staying temperate, in staying away from the bottle. Up until this point, all temperance groups had been of the finger wagging variety. We're going to fix you, we're going to save you, we're going to tell you how to do it. I don't know if that irks you. But if you want to talk about aversion therapy, wag your finger at me and I will be averted. It was always, and so initially the Washingtonians were, they realized that they would help both each other, and then they began to go out and recruit other drunks into their society, and they kept it close. It was for reformed drunkards only. And as such, they met once a night. They charged 25 cents initiation fee, 12 and a half cents a month dues. And it was required that you then also engage in ongoing service within the society, helping others. One of their phrases was something to the extent of, be the man who brings a man. The society began to grow in fairly large numbers, both in Baltimore, and others requested. They were the first closed meetings. Only reformed drunkards were invited in and allowed to come, and allowed to attend the meetings. And they began to get pressure to open it up to others. And so they began to hold public meetings. And in these public meetings, as well as in the private meetings, it was in that mutual aid society method that had begun to be well formed in the temperance offerings, it would generally involve a telling of a story. Someone who had been reformed, which was the term of the day, or would stand up and tell them their story of how they their downfall into drunkenness, and how they were released from bondage, how they were found their freedom through the society, and there were. And they began to get even more interest. And the public meetings became even more popular. And there was an increased demand for non-drunkards to join in this. This society began to grow. These initial six began to grow into others, and they began to go out on lecture tours, just as the temperance societies would travel town to town to town and talk and give talks on temperance or on prohibition or so too the Washingtonians went out around the country, and at one point initially had about 8,000 members, of which 500 were reformed drunkards. So they had a particularly, and as they grew, they had a particularly smaller and smaller number or percentage of actual reformed drunks, recovered drunks, versus the total membership. They were very good at getting people to not drink. Many of their best speakers suffered multiple relapses, which at that point they only used to spur themselves on even more, and actually oftentimes even gained even more fame by admitting to it in the public confession. And that was one of the, they spoke about the need for a public confession and a public admission of adherence to temperance, a public pledge, the demand to be of service, social entertainment, sober social entertainment, and once again, depending upon the society, participation in a religious organization. This was growing at a very rapid rate within the 18. This Washingtonian society, many people are familiar with it, and they think this is long term. It lasted for about 3 years. That's it. It fell apart real quickly. They were good at getting people sober, but they didn't have an ideology or a program of what to do after that. It was all based upon just showing up, telling the story, what it was like, what it's like now, engaging in mutual aid with one another, but they had no practical program of action to stay sober. They charged dues, and fees. It started off as very much a artisan, tradesman, working class society. It grew in rapid number in size, and attracted a great deal of popularity from the upper classes for a while, who then began to influence, let's face it, it was a very classist society in the 1800s, and that began to change. Politics and political ideas began to be allowed and introduced and spoken about. Leaders were exalted and glorified, even, though their flaws were oftentimes known. What I'm mentioning here, and I mention this, are some of the reasons for its demise. This is also the roots of the foundations of perhaps why I'm still here today, and why our fellowships exist today, because it was the lessons learned by the mistakes of the Washingtonians that oftentimes prompted, also through our own personal experience in the founding of Alcoholics Anonymous, but prompted the creation of our traditions, what I've just talked about, no dues or fees. Our leaders are but trusted servants, they do not govern. We have no association with outside enterprises. Our primary purpose is to. And all of these traditions are the direct result of the mistakes that were made known to Bill Wilson and the early members, because of their study of what happened to the Washingtonians. So the history does have a purpose. We need to know who has walked these paths before. We need to know what has worked and what hasn't worked before, and why it worked and why it didn't work. So in 3 short years, that was over and done with. Other charter clubs, other sobriety clubs, other reform clubs began to develop in through the late 1800s. The latter part of the 19th century, and I'll begin to cover some of this in the formative work of the founding of Alcoholics Anonymous in the early talk next week, but really involves the development of our the various psychological and psychotherapeutic approaches to alcoholism and other addictions as a result. Also, in the late 1800s, we saw the rise of certain what would become crucial philosophical ingredients to a 12-step fellowship in the writings of William James, his Varieties of Religious Experience. I'll quote something here. In the along with the continued existence and development of temperance reform societies, and they was also the growth of inebriate asylums. If, once again, talking about a classless society, if you were qualified to get into it, there were of course. Ultimately, they developed the workhouse asylums, you know, for the drunkards that towns just wanted to get off the street and shipped off into the insane asylums and whatnot. But there were inebriate asylums. Oftentimes, it depended upon how far gone you were and how much money you still had. If you were a lower class drunkard in the gutter or kicked out of homeless and whatnot, you were sent off to the inebriate farm where you were told that you absolutely had to find religion, and you also had that your only path to recovery was also going to come through hard work and hard labor and finally being able to maintain a respectable job. If you had money and you were an inebriate, you were told it was because of the stress of modern civilization and you needed to relax and take it easy. And so there were two very, once again, the asylum system that was growing in the late 1800s was just amazingly, again, going in two different directions. William James wrote the book in 1902, but he began writing it in the late 1800s under the title Varieties of Religious Experience. And he began to explore what had already been an ongoing situation, which was religious conversion. These temperance societies, many, and by this, by the late 1800s, all involved a religious aspect. That one needed to find, for the most part, it was a Christian path toward recovery. And that it was only by seeking, and accepting a Christian way of life were you ever going to be able to, recover from your drunkenness. James began by suggesting a common thread ran through the quest for religious experience and the quest for intoxication. The sway of alcohol, he wrote, over mankind is unquestionably due to its power to stimulate the mystical faculties of human nature, usually crushed to earth by the cold facts and dry criticisms of the sober hour. Sobriety diminishes, discriminates, and says no. Drunkenness expands, unites, and says yes. He spoke about the hot place in a person's consciousness, the habitual center of one's personal energy, and noted that this center was the target of the religious conversion. It was also the target that was affected by alcohol. So once again, spiritus contra spiritum, both are thirsting for that sense that either spirit or spirits give us. He talks about this as the conversion experiences, the supernormal elements often found within such experiences, voices, visions, photisms, lights, awareness of some superior power, overpowering insights, a melting of emotions, a sense of cleansing, raptures, close connectedness to others, a new and brilliantly clear sense of purpose, and a new spiritual enthusiasm and zest for life. This is what he talks about in terms of what it was like to experience a religious conversion. When the new center of personal energy, wrote, has been subconsciously incubated so long as to be just ready to open into flower, hands off is the only word for us. It must burst forth unaided. Thirty-two years after the publication of that book, that book, Varieties of Religious Experience, was handed to Bill Wilson in Towns Hospital on December 15th, 1934. On December 14th, 1934, Bill Wilson had his spiritual experience, his white light experience. It was as though the clear rush of wind, not of air, but of spirit, rushed through him. What would become in the downtown clubhouse referred to as Bill's hot flash. But on December 15th, Bill was handed the Varieties of Religious Experience by Abby Thatcher. And when he read in there of this religious conversion experience, all of a sudden he began to realize what had happened to him the day before. By the 1900s, doctors, the scientific community had once again begun to look upon alcoholism, you know, as in less of a moral, with less an idea of it being a moral turpitude or a moral failing, and more of just a disease, an illness. But again, there was little effort given to it as any sort of physical ailment. Rush had talked about it in the 1790s, that there was a physical compulsion. And the doctors realized that once, in the early 1900s rather, that they didn't understand why these drunks just couldn't stay, you know, couldn't stop once they started. And they always looked upon it as that compulsion to drink. A compulsion to drink that ultimately would take them to a place where their body fell into such disrepair that they would die. These asylums, the temperance unions at that point, some were still of the mind that better to let the drunkard die and just to get rid of them. And their primary focus became that of trying to keep the youth and other people from becoming drunkards. So once again, it was an earlier version of Nancy Reagan's Just Say No. How's that working for you? You know, I mean, it does work if you don't have a mind that's sickened and a body that's allergic. It will work. I was watching the news the other day, and they did a you know again, this is concurrent to all of this, but now it's getting the headlines, you know, the our opioid crisis. Like, that's something new. Come on. 1812, Confessions of an Opium Eater, you know, was published. And you know, but they're talking about, this particular segment was talking about the sports injuries and the prescription of opiates. And they interviewed this one basketball guy who had, you know, suffered something. He said, yeah, they gave me Percocets, and I tried it for a day or so, and I didn't really like how it made me feel, and so I stopped taking them. It's like, that's what a normal person does. Mm-hmm. They use it when it's supposed to, and they don't really like how it makes them feel, and they stop. And then they interviewed a bunch of, you know, little pimply-faced other little kids, and they say, well, we've learned in class that we really shouldn't do it. I was like, there's going to be some point where that little lecture in class is not, when you come in between, it ain't going to work. And that's why we're here. And that's why what I've talked about, I'm glad to have gotten it out of the way, but it's important to realize that this whole country has always dealt with, bless you, man's inability to deal with a certain portion of man's being unable to deal with moderation. Also, we have always dealt with our inability to be moderate toward our thirst for. What we'll look at sometime next week is that the 12-step program allows me not so much to stop, but it helps me to not start again. Because it's not just a redirection, it's a transformation where I still thirst, but it's I thirst for that higher calling, that higher spirit, the spiritus, not the spiritum. And there, it involves the fellowship and development, and the history of 12-step fellowships as begun in Alcoholics Anonymous involves mutual aid, but it doesn't stop there. It doesn't call for temperance. It does call for abstinence. But not for the community as a whole, but only for those who are unable to drink safely. And there's an explanation for it in my physical health. Bless you. The roots of our traditions, as I mentioned earlier, the roots of our concepts of service are there because of the realization that we need to, not with missionary zeal, but with one who has walked a path and can offer a lending hand, an open hand, a welcoming hand, and guide someone on their own journey to their own story. The roots are there. The medical community has moved us from bloodletting, you know, to anabuse. Rush talked about emetics, you know, back in the 1800s, and then they, you know, everything old is new again. But what we've set the stage for is what will happen during Prohibition to a couple of hapless, hopeless drunks as the result of legal entanglements, failed business deals, business defeats, moral collapse, ego deflation, and some really committed wives. And a wholesale miracle was born. Why don't I leave it there at that point?